technology.ie. It's Monday, December 22nd, 2014.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
Keith Folter, Irish Talk. This is Conor Mwinacon in the Black Knight studio, and I'm on Skype with Tommy Collison. Hi, Tommy.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going very well. And yourself?
Very good, very good.
Tommy, I've asked you to come on the show today to talk about crypto parties and something you're involved in at the moment, which is training people how to use encryption to protect their privacy online. I'm going to ask you more about that in a minute. But first of all, bring us up to date with Tommy Collison. You're a student these days in New York.
Yeah, that's right. I'm midway through my second year at New York University, majoring in journalism and politics. And I guess because I grew up around computers, this sort of kind of encryption and privacy stuff seems to be like where the two converge, as in where privacy and technology and journalism and everything kind of mesh together. And so it's a question of kind of teaching journalists and students and kind of activists and everyone why privacy is important and like how to use it.
So we've heard so much about it in the past year with, of course, Edward Snowden and the revelations that just keep coming out, Tommy. What, and I mean, that's the one thing, if you like, that Snowden said when he was interviewed, when he made his revelations. He said, encryption works, use it, this is how you protect yourself. You can't trust the government, you can't trust anyone.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, this is the thing that, you know, Edward Snowden and his leaks did start off the current conversation, but it does go back kind of further than that. Is when you're using tools like Facebook, tools like Twitter, you are basically kind of the product. And so those social networks and the companies, the ad agencies that they work with, their business model depends on them having a profile of you, your likes, your interests, where you are in the world, how old you are, stuff like this. And so it depends on knowing things about you. And so you're kind of the product. Mm. And there's been a move recently in the last kind of couple of years to say, hang on a minute, I do want privacy. And I mean, you know, I'm 20 years old. And so the running joke with my generation is that, oh, you know, young people these days don't care about privacy. And I really do get worried when people say that, because privacy has nothing to do with like legality, as in you can want privacy for things that are very kind of everyday, as in who you are with your boss is not who you are with your family, who's not who you are with your brothers. And so we do kind of use privacy and we do want our own kind of private space, even though that has nothing to do with, you know, kind of government spying on us or even kind of Facebook tracking us across the web.
I agree entirely with you, Tommy, but do you see the paradox here as well, in the sense that, and I'm going to ask you to explain it, but in the sense that you, I've known online, your brothers, of course, are involved in their current startup,
Stripe,
which is hugely successful, and they've been online and blogging and tweeting. What age were you, Tommy, when you started blogging? I think you were in your early teens.
Yeah, I was about 12 years old. And it's interesting, you know, people often say, you know, how can you care about privacy if you use these tools, if, you know, you're on Twitter and you are blogging. But privacy isn't a question of, like, people knowing things about you. It's the ability to control what people know about you. It's this ability to control the information flow and to make sure that information flow is, I think the word they use in academics is, like, appropriate, in that what I tell you in a Skype call, you know, I'm revealing it to you. I'm not revealing it to anyone else. And so, you know, blogging and tweeting isn't inherently something that reduces your privacy, because you're controlling what information you put out. You're choosing to only put certain photos from the party up on Facebook. You're, you know, choosing to share news with one friend and not another. And, you know, you're choosing it to share with friends and not your boss. And so I think that it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking that, you know, anyone who uses Facebook obviously doesn't care about privacy. But even with the rise in popularity of something like Snapchat, where, you know, you take a photo and send it to your friends, but then it disappears after 10 seconds. That the fact that these images aren't permanent, I think, is part of the reason why it's so popular. In that we, you know, teenagers and young people don't want a permanent record of what they're up to online all the time, but they do want to share with their friends.
Is that a common view, do you feel, among people your age, Tommy? Are people aware of the importance of privacy, or is it just people who are media savvy and studying journalism like yourself?
I don't think so. I think everyone is kind of cognizant of this privacy, and that you often, if you talk to any young person and you go onto their Facebook, they have it locked down such that, you know, their friends can see things, but their parents, who they are friends with, can't see, you know, the photos from the party last weekend. And so that even as they navigate these new social spaces, and obviously, you know, we've no idea really, you know, Facebook is too new, and we've no idea how our social lives are going to play out in these online realms. But even so, you know, teenagers are working out, you know, the privacy settings such that their parents can see some things but not others. And, you know, the drama that sort of plays out on Facebook pages, that people are aware of kind of who sees what, and they're very much in control of that. I think it's not a popular narrative that you know, kind of news stories want to go for the kind of sensationalist angle. But I do think that teenagers are smarter than we give them credit for. And I think they do care about this stuff.
So, Tommy, you've started doing these crypto parties as a community initiative where you're based in New York in college at the moment. Tell me about the first one of those. How did it go, and what kind of response did you get?
Yeah, so I mean, I was very interested when I came to New York and started studying journalism, and that I'd be talking to other students, and they'd, you know, say something about wanting to be the next Bob Woodward, and you know the Watergate scandal, and I think that's great, and I think that, you know, investigative journalism is, you know, a non-negotiable part of a functioning, healthy democracy. But what they don't realize, and what people don't realize, is that it's much harder to do investigative journalism now than it was in the 1970s. In that, you know, whereas the U.S. government would ask, you know, Woodward and Bernstein for their source, and then the journalists would refuse, and that would kind of be the end of it, because the government couldn't do anything about it. Whereas now, you know, you can tap their phones, you can subpoena all of their internet records, you can tap their cell phone and see where they went and who they were there with. And even, it's not even kind of as insidious as that, but it's also, you know, the new technologies that are coming forward is in New York, there's an option to link your credit card to your subway metro card and like top up automatically. And that sounds great, and it is very convenient. But what happens is the MTA, the authority that runs the subway, now know where you are. And, you know, that's immediately linked to your debit card, which, you know, you use to pay for a coffee or you use to go shopping. And so they start to be able to build up this very complete picture of who you are, where you go, what you do, and who you do that with. Because they're pulling from all these different locations. They're getting your cell phone data so they know where you are. They get your, you know, credit card data so they know where you traveled to. And so as far as journalism is concerned, I didn't see a lot of evidence that journalism students were thinking about this stuff, as in they were following the Snowden stuff, but they didn't think that it directly affected them. As in, this is always what I find with the US government. That, you know,
the problem is the chilling effect, Tommy, isn't it? If you know that you can be surveilled, if you know that that, for example, if a journalist, if Bob Woodward and Bernstein, for example, told their sources, "We will protect you," that meant something back then in the 1970s. But now, if a journalist tells you that they will protect you, you're going to say, "Well, can he really?"
Exactly. Yeah, it's become much harder to promise your source anonymity than it was in years prior. And I mean, you know, technology is such a force for good that we can't exactly expect journalists to go back to kind of notebooks and papers exclusively. And so, yeah, I wanted to position myself as someone who could talk to journalists and talk to journalism students about, you know, there are these tools. They're not, you know, perfect, like nothing's NSA proof, but they will make it a lot harder for you to be surveilled, and it will go some of the way towards you being able to better serve your sources, and also better serve, you know, your news gathering, in that you'll be a better news gatherer because you won't shy away from the stories that could be unpopular.
There's a lot of work involved here, though, Tommy, because I read a piece recently. I don't recall exactly who wrote it, but he was involved in sort of teaching Glenn Greenwald about encryption techniques and things like that in order to help him in the work he was doing when preparing to work with or to do the story on Edward Snowden. And there's a learning curve there. How did you find that learning curve?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Glenn Greenwald story is particularly interesting in that the Snowden contacted him first in kind of January or February, or even before. But he contacted him about a year before the leaks happened. But Glenn Greenwald couldn't set up this encryption on his own. And, you know, like the probably the biggest story of the last kind of decade almost didn't happen because this stuff is so difficult. And so for that reason, I think that there's a huge kind of all technologists should be working with journalists to kind of share the knowledge. And if you know how to use this system, you should be teaching someone else how to use it. As far as my own learning curve, I mean, I grew up with computers and I still struggled with this stuff. And I still kind of sometimes make mistakes and I'm left there scratching my head going, how do I do this? And for that reason, I mean, teaching is also kind of useful because you don't really understand anything until you can show someone else. But, like encryption software is kind of infamous for being just very esoteric and very user unfriendly. And so that's why it's super important, I think, for people who do have some measure of understanding to turn around and say, look, let's get 15 people together in a room with their laptops and let's make them a little more secure and a little more private than they were when they came in.
So what does it boil down to, Tommy, when you get those people together in a room? What are you teaching them?
I'm teaching them about specific privacy software, stuff like... So stuff like the Tor browser, which is a web browser that bounces your connection through different servers in the world and basically makes your connection more anonymous, or learning how to use math software to encrypt your emails and your instant messaging. It is very kind of stop and go and stop and go, and that, you know, you stand up there at the start and you talk about why this stuff is important, but then you really just have to kind of sit down with someone and, you know, point through how to install it, how to use it, what happens if something breaks, because something invariably does. And it very much is kind of like no two workshops are the same because everyone comes with a different level of understanding. And I mean, I remember doing an encryption workshop with someone who hadn't heard of Snowden. And so, you know, you're kind of working with very different levels of understanding.
So what kind of response have you got?
The response has been positive. I think that generally, you know, a lot of people don't believe that they're in danger from the NSA and from governments. And I mean, even when the Snowden stories came out, the journalists involved, Greenwald and those, would do interviews and... you know, that the cable news person would be like, you know, I've read over it and, you know, I'm not scared. I mean, I don't think the NSA will find anything interesting if they read my emails, which is a pretty dangerous standard to have, that just because you yourself are not in danger, that this isn't a very scary precedent to have. And I mean, mostly in America, people don't think that the NSA is going to target them. They think they're going to target terrorists, which you find in practice usually is coded racism for Muslims. But, It's been an interesting kind of blowback in that you're trying to fight not only the fact that this encryption software is very difficult to use and all this, but also people aren't sure why this is relevant to them. And so you have to cross that first hurdle before you even start dealing with the software.
Absolutely. It's a 2-hour workshop. Obviously, there isn't that much you can cover in that space of time, Tommy. But you're getting across the basics of it, and I suppose giving people pointers as to where to go further. Have you got blog posts and other resources available to people on the subject?
Yeah. So I started writing a blog about a year or two ago that was specifically dedicated to kind of privacy and the future of journalism after Snowden. And after, you know, the U.S. government was found to want to basically eliminate anonymity online. And, the argument is always that, oh, it's stopping terrorism. Oh, it's for national security. But, I mean, when NSA slides get leaked that say things like collect it all, partner it all, sniff it all, you realize that their stated goal is actually to make sure that no one can ever be anonymous on the internet in case some small subset of the population are engaged in criminal activities, which is obviously a very kind of overbearing and far too stringent action to take. Mm. But yeah, so I've written a good bit on kind of why privacy is important and what technologists need to do and then also what journalists need to do.
Very good. I've done a lot of interviews with people over the last year. I've spoken to Mark Little, for example, of Storyful, where you interned, I think, at one stage briefly. And I've spoken to other people involved in journalism and media. It comes up a lot in our podcast series here on technology.ie. There's a real understanding, I think, in the industry, if you like, in among journalists and the media, that things have changed and changed radically, not just on the one hand in terms of privacy and the restrictions and complications that involves for journalists journalists going about investigative work in particular. But also, on the other hand, the way your product is delivered, the way that we try and reach audiences in 2015 now and present, I suppose, the pressure for clicks and traffic and all of that as well. How is that reflected now in terms of the course of study that you're doing? Is there an awareness of that? Obviously, it's not all ink and radio anymore, but there must be some very interesting discussions going on about the future of media in academic circles.
Yeah, no, definitely there is. And I think that you'll find that universities will start to teach journalism students about kind of both collaborating, but also kind of synthesizing information, in that with the internet and with everyone having a camera phone, it doesn't make everyone a journalist, but it does give people who are trained in journalism a huge trove of information and photos and material to use and to collate their story with. And I think that Mark Little actually has the right idea in terms of, you know, that journalists will be working very, very closely with, you know, the I'm using air quotes here, but, you know, kind of the citizen journalists, in that I think that there will always be a need for people who are trained in journalism and who know the history and who know, you know, the kind of ins and outs of reporting, if for no other reason than that they can write compelling stories. But I do think that, you know, journalism needs to be brought into the 21st century and needs to keep up with the kind of digital changes and revolutions that are happening. Interestingly, Jay Rosen, who's a pretty famous media critic and professor at NYU, is teaching a class next semester on just the future of the New York Times. And so I think it's definitely a timely course to be teaching, and I wish I was taking it. But, you know, people are obviously cognizant that things are changing, and, you know, that, you know, ad margins are down and classified ads have basically disappeared because of things like Craigslist. And I think that good universities will be cognizant of that fact and won't just be teaching straight up reporting like they probably once were.
Are you enjoying college life, Tommy?
I really am. I think that, you know, college is a really great time, and I'm incredibly lucky to be able to spend 4 years of my life in New York City, especially as a journalist, in that there's just always things happening, and, you know, people are passing through, and, you know, authors are doing events, and we were having a pretty tumultuous time of it recently with the Eric Garner and the Michael Brown protests. They were pretty big in New York, and I think it's great as a journalist to live somewhere that things are happening. Be that in the US or in Ireland or anywhere else, but just to have a pool of just interesting events that are occurring.
Absolutely. Well, I'm following you on Twitter and Facebook and keeping up with the interesting events that you record and that everyone else records. So it is definitely a wonderful time, whether you're living in the centre of it, maybe as you are for a while, or wherever indeed you are, that it's great to keep in touch with people. And it's good to talk to you, Tommy. You're home for Christmas anyway.
Home for Christmas, yeah. Good. New York kind of gets to you after a little while, and I was looking forward to going somewhere a little bit more quiet and seeing my family again.
Good. And Patrick and John, are they coming home for Christmas?
They are indeed, yeah. Although they're on a tighter work schedule than I am, so I'm the last call, and I'm, you know, the one who's going to finish college and get the degree. It's something they never managed to do just yet.
They might do yet. You'd never know.
Exactly.
Tommy, I want to just say best of luck and best wishes to yourself and to Patrick and to John as well, and to your family, and continued success to them with Stripe and to you with your studies and your other initiatives, which we will watch with great interest. We'll post a link to your next NYC encryption event. Obviously, it's only valid for people in New York, but tell us when and where it's on.
Yeah, so the next encryption workshop that's happening in New York is on the 30th of January. I was actually very lucky in that a book publisher in New York, after I spoke at an event, came forward and were like, would you like us to give you a space to host these encryption workshops? And I was, of course, you know, delighted. I can't exactly have 10, 15 people in my college dorm room. But yeah, so it's in Brooklyn on January 30th, and it's looking to be a good event.
Very good. We'll post a link to it, as I said, Tommy, and maybe you'll do one in Ireland next time you're around again, if there's interest, and if people are interested and they're listening to the show, do leave a comment on the site at technology.ie, or you can follow Tommy on Twitter. What's the best place to contact you, Tommy? Twitter? Website?
Yeah, Twitter has a link to my website and my email address and everything, but I'm usually on Twitter a good bit, so that's probably the best place to reach me.
Very good. Tommy Collison on Twitter. TommyCollison.com is the website I think I'm looking at here at the moment. And happy Christmas to you, Tommy.
Awesome. Happy holidays. Thank you.